scientific explanation for this. And this explanation has to do with the nature and the character of the world economy, how it came into being, how it functions, etc., and what it requires to exist. And that we said that you see these wars and these threats of wars, and that is to say the camp of those folk who have historically dominated the world, Europe, North America, etc. This crisis has its basis a political economy that requires for its existence, that has as its genesis, its basis, the theft of human and material resources of the rest of us. So discussion in this one session that will help us to understand in any depth all of these questions, but we will, as we move forward, we'll get to some of the questions, the implications that all of this has. And so we're saying that the threats against Venezuela and the very likelihood of another of other attacks to try to overturn that government, when you see the threats against Korea and Iran, etc., what you're looking at is a crisis, because there's been an historical movement, especially resources that the whole empire rests upon and requires for its existence. And now, since these revolutions and near revolutions have been going on for so long, it means they're taking back resources. That is a statement of politics that hasn't been so obvious to everyone. You can peek it a little bit because you can see the plummeting value of the dollar. Because you know that there's this incredible trade deficit that exists in the world. And imperialists don't tolerate trade deficits. And that's it, and etc. They don't tolerate trade deficits. But to now, because the world is changing, they can't do everything the way they want to do, the way they used to do it anymore. So that's been one creation of the dollar, etc. These are some manifestations, but there were explanations that could be given for that, of sorts. As I say, we purposely have allowed the dollar to plummet to deal with the trade deficit, trading with each other. And if you buying everything from them, but they ain't buying much from you, right? That's a deficit, and that hurts your pocketbook, because all you're doing is spending. That's like the African community experiences a severe trade deficit with white power. You know, right here in this country, everything they buy, where they getting it from? They're getting it from China, they're getting it from all these other places, and China has, and so China got all the white people money, right? And China ain't buying nothing, they won't buy nothing. And so they say, now what we're doing, not just China, but it's, and keep people in this country from simply buying everything from over there and get people over there to buy from here, we'll let the value of the dollar shrink. That means it's cheaper for people to buy here than it is for you to buy there. And that being the case, you are less likely to buy their stuff, and they're more likely inclined to buy your stuff. That's the theory behind it, right? And the question is whether they're going to be able to escape from this this predicament that they are confronted with. And it's not going to be easy. And in fact, the evidence that it's not going to be easy is now, because of the magnificent deficit that they have with China in contest and other places, you see that everything comes from China is contaminated. This is trade war. When you open your newspaper, dog food from China, et cetera, et cetera. It is a part of a trade war that is occurring. Now, trade war, this is one way trade war happens. Usually what they do is pick up a gun, send a few ships over and say, this is not the way it's going to be. But China is becoming so significant a power that you can't mess with China like that. You understand? So they have this deficit. So Japan makes an incredibly good car. Germany makes a good car. The U.S., nobody but people in Alabama buy cars from the U.S. anymore. Southern flag waving, you know, patriotic free purchasing, because they want value, which is what capitalism is supposed to be about anyway. If nobody buys from you, if your product isn't good enough to survive on the market, you're supposed to fail. They brag about that. And young people don't know what the hell I'm talking about. Jerry Butler. What's a Jerry Butler? Nice. Amen. So, economy, that's what the deficit is. Is that, you know, cleared up at all? And but what Penny's going to talk about, what we want to talk about now is the fact, crisis of imperialism that represents itself in the form of war, threat to war, etc., is a crisis that's born out of a shift in the economic relationship between the imperial powers and the vast majority of others of us. That was an economic, we talk about political economy when we were talking about the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan being a manifestation of crisis based on the fact, talk about the manifestation of the economic crisis. And this is going to be a very good discussion, and it's going to employ some language that they use, and the reason you don't read the stuff in the newspaper because they got a whole special language that they use that only they can understand. So you get to that, yeah, I don't understand, what the hell is that, right? And you know, they talk about leveraging this and that, and they talk about, what's that, super trading where cats come in and buy up all of the, like the mortgages, and then trade it on the market. What's that called?
Hedge funds
and stuff like that. What the hell is a hedge fund? You know, all this kind of stuff that they use language that most of us don't even know what the hell they're talking about, so we don't pay attention to it. So Pentagon has been watching this process, and she's going to talk about that and how it's representative of the crisis of imperialism. We call it the crisis of imperialism. But in the old days, we used to talk about how it means that the end of the white man is near. and it is. We're looking at the death of white power. And it's a paroxysm. Is that how you say the word? A paroxysm, you know, when something is in a sort of death throes that you can characterize it as, you call it that or something else. But I believe it's paroxysm. I believe it's a death throw. I don't think there's anything thrilling about it other than that. The rigor mortis is after it's dead and it's in a state of what we might refer to as permanent erection. but before Penny gets there, I think it's important for us to say a few things about political economy. Because most people in the world, including people who are experts on the question, don't understand political economy. So we're going to say a few words about political economy. Now, the best sources of, and because people talk about political economy like they do religion and magic and stuff like that, there's really not something you kind of understand in a deep, profound way. It's not something that you can really get a grip on in terms of why certain phenomena occur, you know, like in the world, right? But there is a science of society. And the whole question, the economic life of society, the means by which things which are necessary for our existence, food, the acquisition of food, clothing and shelter, the means by which they are produced, distributed, and the relationships that people have in this process, right, can help anybody to make predictions about how that society will act under given circumstances, and can actually predict the demise of the system itself. Once you know what brings it into being, right, you know what will take it out of existence. Ain't that right? Yeah. And if you know some things about these laws of society, well, anyway. So I just want to say that the Marxists give the best definitions of the work of society. Of how a political economy functions, what gives rise to a particular, what they characterize as modes of production, etc. They get the best. The capitalists like the priests. you know, in terms of their explanations are so ephemeral and have to do with magic and mystery, etc. Because I said the Marxists give the best definition, it's not the same as saying the Marxists give the right explanation, but it's the best. It's like Marxists like to say, for example, if you try to understand what is it that causes bad weather, storms and lightning and thunder, and somebody says that what causes lightning, thunder, and bad weather is that God not pleased with us, and they're upset, and that's evidence of upset by the gods. Well, now that's patently wrong. Some people believe that, and they will work off of that. And but somebody might say something like, "Well, what causes the thunder and bad weather is because there are these molecules and things that work in the sky, and they bump into each other, and they et cetera, et cetera." That might be wrong too. But at least it's an explanation that's based on some kind of materialist, you know, attempt to get to it. And you can work with that and find your way to the truth, hopefully. You ain't gonna never come to no right conclusions, you know, trying to keep appease the gods. But some people do, you know, they take fruits and stuff like that and slay lambs and stuff and leave it at altars, and then hopefully that'll bring good weather. Only thing it does is bring maggots. Bad odors, etc., right? So, I'm just saying that the Marxists, the thing about the Marxists, they are dead wrong, but they are trying to offer some kind of materialist explanation for how this thing works. That's what makes it best. Now, I'm going to tell you what the Marxists, I've got this scribbling up there, is because the Marxists have an explanation for what they call the development of human society. I didn't say the right society, right? I said human society. And they see human society having developed through vertically from the lower to the higher levels, okay? And from their perspective, the lowest level of human society is what they characterize as primitive communism. And primitive communism, according to them, is that time in human society when everybody's equal and everybody shares everything collectively, and there's no private ownership of land and resources, etc. And people, you know, live in relative harmony, and the only contradiction. Is a contradiction with nature. Do you understand what I mean by a contradiction with nature?
Yeah.
Huh? Means that, you know, when it rains, where you have some way that can shelter yourself, or if it snows, you have a way to protect yourself, you get cold, you have warmth, etc. This is the profound contradiction that the primitive, that according to the Marxists, exist at that juncture. But then they say, and the explanation they give is a very strange explanation. They say the reason there's all this equality is because of scarcity. Does that make sense to you?
No, it doesn't.
Why? Somebody tell me why it doesn't make sense to you. Huh? Why doesn't it make sense? Yes, Master.
If there's scarcity, there's going to be struggle for the scarce resource.
Right.
There's not going to be, right. Somebody's going to have to, most right. of it, and the rest of them are going to have very little.
But the fact is that we see every day the consequences of scarcity that's been imposed on Africa and other places. We see nothing but turmoil. But in those places where they're wealthy and they have a lot of stuff, where in fact inequality has been raised to its highest levels, but there's a lot of stuff, you see more social peace than you do in places where there is scarcity. Isn't that right? I mean, we've seen that, the real results of that, right? So here's what they say, though. Why do they say scarcity? Because it's really interesting that this is coming from a Marxist, because it seems to me that it relies on like a religious philosophy of the nature of human beings being bad, naturally. And the reason I say that is because here you have what they call primitive communism, right? But and in primitive communism, everybody's equal, and women are more equal than anybody. Women are really like the center of the society. And the reason that is true, and I believe that historically there's some truth and some basis in this assumption, is because women in these circumstances are the center of production for what's necessary for us to eat, to make the clothes, they keep the little gardens and stuff around the house, et cetera, et cetera. So survival is more definite than how what men are doing is hunting. And you might go out, you might catch a rabbit, you might not catch nothing. You know, you come home with your tail between your legs and honey, I didn't catch nothing, right? And so, like, women, you know, are more equal than anybody else. But at a certain juncture in this development, you see that people learn how to do things like domesticate animals. So we don't kill the animal when we catch it this time. We catch them, we domesticate them, and then they reproduce on the spot, right? And then the same thing is, you know, like growing crops and stuff like that. Agriculture begins to emerge. And then you have a stable source of what's necessary for us to exist. And men, and this is the overthrow, what they call the overthrow of mother right. Because the power of women gets overthrown in this process because women were dominant forces because they were key, like, to the production of what was necessary for us to exist. Y'all with me? That makes sense, doesn't it? Yeah. And then what happens is that there's the overthrow of mother's right, but more than that, you have the emergence of class question, because once you have more than what's necessary for us to exist, which is what occurs with the domestication of both animals and agriculture, etc., you have what is now called surplus. You got more than what's needed. And then the question arises of who controls the surplus. And the one who controls the surplus, they say, becomes the new, you have the emergence of class distinction, the ruling class, right? Okay? And this then represents the overturn of primitive communism and the emergence of slavery. We ain't talking about way down upon the Suwannee River kind of slavery. We're not talking about old black Joe kind of slavery, right? Mint julep, you know, in Alabama kind of slavery. We're talking about, you know, slavery, they say, that, you know, you saw essentially in Europe and et cetera. In fact, what we refer to as like Yugoslavians and Czechoslavians and the whole concept of Slav is these are the group, that's where the word slave comes from. From Slavs, you know, like of Europe, right? You knew that, didn't you? Yeah, and so that's what they're talking about. They're talking about this. Now, with slavery, the primary contradiction no longer is between humans and nature, but the primary contradiction in the society is between whom? The slave and the slave master, isn't that right? And the so-called slave is somebody who works all the time, and the product of the slave's labor is appropriated by the slave master, and so the slave master takes everything that's necessary, you know, all the products, etc. Y'all with me? That's the primary contradiction: slave master. The slave has no incentive to produce, does it? The slave have any incentive to produce? Because if I work, I go to work all day, damn. And it's not like I'm married to this guy, right? And then they take everything at the end of the day that's been produced. So the slave, it's a system that's enforced by brutality, you know, and the slave fights back by doing things like breaking tools accidentally, working as little as necessary because there's no incentive for me here. I ain't get done out of it but a butt kicking, right? And so the whole slavery system is overturned. It's not a very good explanation for how that happens, but it does get overturned, you know, rebellions and things like that. But part of what happens is that this ushers into a whole new system that's referred to as feudalism. Feudalism is the Robin Hood era, you know, King Off and all this kind of stuff, you know, where now people are tied to the land. They are no longer slaves. They can't be bought or sold as slaves and things like that. But they are tied to the land. And the land is owned by the nobility, by the landlords. And if the land gets sold, they go with the land, right? And now you have a situation where part of what they earn, they keep for themselves. But the vast majority goes to the landlord, right? So there's a slight greater incentive here. And in each case, the slave could see the expropriation of his of value that's going to the slave master, and now the one who works on the feudal land for the landlord can see the value, part of the product that he or she produces going to the landlord. It's visible. The exploitation is visible. That's what we call exploitation. The exploitation is this relationship of expropriation of value and wealth. It's an economic concept, by the way. And in the instance of slavery, it requires oppression to exploit. And now you have feudalism, and where they can see part of what they produce, they can keep themselves, others going to the landlord. Y'all with us? So this ain't the best system either. You have, you know, you feudal rebellions and things like that. There are some in European history. And then the Marxists run into a problem because they don't have a very good explanation of how we get from, and they by the way, the Marxists characterize each of these developments, this vertical development from the lower to the higher, as progress in human society, okay? So we progressed from primitive communism to slavery, and now we're about to progress from slavery to feudalism. And the productive capacity becomes greater in part because people can keep a part of what it is they own. Now this villainous thing happens, where they move from feudalism to capitalism. Capitalist society, the primary contradiction is that exists not between, as before, the landlord and the feudal serf, but it exists between the working class, the workers, and the ruling class. This becomes, these are the primary antagonists, the primary contradiction that exists inside that society, okay? So now, in fact, the exploitation becomes, initially it's rather obvious in Europe because you have a situation where they had children working in factories with the rise of capitalism. In fact, if you remember Charles Dickens and the Christmas Carol, the story of Scrooge, the capitalist boss and what have you, and you got a little Tiny Tim, the little crippled white boy, and then you've got Bob Cratchit, the nephew of Scrooge, and Scrooge was a very bad guy because at Christmas time when people wanted to have a good time and get down with Santa Claus, and Scrooge would go buy humbug and wouldn't give gifts to anybody and worked everybody even during Christmas, etc. Well, this was a criticism of capitalism during that period of time, where you had the capitalist, you know, ruling class was ruthless. All they cared about was profit, and didn't even like Christmas, so you know the guy was no good. And treated his nephew Bob Cratchit bad, and a little crippled white boy. I mean, I used to cry copious tears over four times. And so you have, and everybody, all the children learn this. You know, Walt Disney makes stuff about it, and you learn how to cry, this, you know, for Tiny Tim and Bob Cratchit, and that bad old Scrooge, right? So you have this kind of contradiction, and so then you have people who are struggling against capitalism. This book by Dickens was a struggle to try to help the capitalists to understand that they ought to change their ways and don't be so mean to the workers and give the workers time off and enjoy Christmas and share Christmas gifts. And Scrooge, as you know, he sees the light because he goes to Christmas past and Christmas future and he changes himself. Well, that was a part of a whole struggle to get the capitalists, because the way they understood it is that the capitalists must be one to treat the workers better. And in many ways, you know, like much of what we call economism of people who even today working to make capitalism act better, treat the people better. And to the extent that this thing is perfected, the exploitation of the capitalist system begins to disappear. You can't see it. It becomes obscure because you get a day off, right? You got a good contract this time, right? But the whole system still stays in place, And the key thing to capitalism, and I'm going to say this right away, I don't want to went off, I'm spending too much time on this. But I want to open this discussion that Penny's going to do, give it a context. See, the key thing about the capitalism that makes it exploitative is the fact that it is from the perspective of the Marxists. And this is something that does happen, is that inside the capitalist system, when somebody goes to work, exploitation is not when you go to the store and you buy something. Most people think that exploitation is because the markup on what you buy. I went and bought a car, right? And the car is only worth such and such, you know, but I paid all of this. And they think that's where the exploitation comes from. They think that's where the capitalists got over. They think when you go to the store and you buy some orange juice and you pay $3 and 60 cents for a half a gallon of orange juice, the orange juice is really only worth $2, and they think that's where the capitalists got over because of the markup of what you bought. But that ain't where the exploitation happens in the capitalist system, inside the system itself. Where exploitation happens is that the people who go to work for the capitalists don't get paid for the value of the product that they produce. They get paid for their ability to produce it. And that's a different thing altogether. Everybody know what the difference is? But the surplus value, but this is what we're talking about. And I'm giving you this as a quick example. Like if each of us worked in a table factory, right? Producing tables right here. This table, each of us, because it's a modern factory, etc., may be able to produce a table an hour in terms of the labor power that goes into it, right? I mean, it may be like one of these, what do you call it, where the belt, the line, and what do you call it?
Assembly line,
right? Where we do it, but in terms of the amount of labor that goes into it, it may be that each of us could produce a table per hour, right? And we get paid $10 an hour, say, right? But the table that we produce gets sold for $30. The difference in the $10 that we got paid and the $30 that they sold it for, minus things like the wear and tear of the factory, you know, and, you know, some other minor things like that, is what they refer to as surplus value. This is where the capitalist profit happens on every instance inside the system itself. Not because of the so-called markup, but it begins what they refer to as the point of production itself. Y'all with me? So they pay the worker not for what was produced, but for your capacity to produce it. Now what do I mean by that? Your capacity to produce is based on the socially required time necessary for you to reproduce your ability to work. What does that mean? How much food it took for you to eat, how many pairs of pants you have to wear during this process, you know, how much rent you had to pay during this process. All of this constitutes like the socially required amount of value that went into your ability to come back to work the next day and the next week and things like that. Which is why, because part of what they pay you for too, which is why, on almost every job, when somebody gets married, you go to the boss and say, "Boss, I just got married, so I think I need a raise." And the boss says, "Yeah, boy, you just got married, we give you a raise, right?" Because what has happened with the raise is, especially in, I'm not talking about African people so much. You know, I'm talking about, unless you work on a job where white people are, right? Because what has happened with the raise is that now there's somebody else who's working for the boss too because of this relationship. Because now what happens is that somebody who irons the clothes that you to wear, right? Fix the food for you to eat, have the baby to reproduce the working class. You have a baby, you go to the boss, say, "Boss, we just had a baby, I need a raise." If you've been all right with boss, he'll give you a raise. Because what is happening is you're reproducing your ability to work through the next generation of people who are going to be going to work for boss. Okay? That's how the thing works. So you work maybe 8 hours a day, right? And maybe 2 of those hours you work for yourself in terms of the amount of value of that's necessary to reproduce your ability to work. Maybe in the first 2 hours you got enough to pay, go on your rent, your food, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That reproduces your capacity to go to work. That's the value. You see? But the other 6 hours they got from you. That's, you know, how the capitalist thing works. So you work 8 hours, only 2 hours you work for yourself. All right? So you're with me on that? Yes, my freaker.
Does that apply to other industries that don't produce products and markets, like people that work for, say, this university, or people working nonprofits, or organizations like that?
Yeah, because it becomes just a little more involved and convoluted, because part of what's happening at this university is that we are enhancing the capacity of people who come through here to do the production, like, in the system, you know, produce itself. That's what the institution is about. That's essentially what the institution is about. And so, and I'm saying a lot of stuff, you look at, you know, stuff on political economy, I'm giving you something to work with, but yes, it does factor in. Then there are other forces who are parasites. I'm talking now about the terms of political economy. And they're characterized as parasites because they don't produce. They live off what other people do, like preachers, right? I mean, I'm not trying to mess with y'all preachers, but they are social. They don't produce anything, but they live off what other folk produce, right? So they are parasites in that sense, you know, like I'm talking out purely economic terms. We can talk about other terms too, but yes. Well, let me move. I'm telling you about the Marxist explanation. I just want to go through all of this so that we can understand. And I'm saying that the Marxists are correct on some very key stuff. But here is the problem with the Marxist analysis. That's why I do this little thing here. Let's see. I got to go back over there because they're videoing and they need the sound. Now, see that asterisk? I've been trying to think of how to demonstrate this thing for a long time, and I can show it sort of like this. Here's the problem. What the Marxists are defining is a social system, as they understand it. But they are undialectical in the sense that they don't understand and cannot see the whole system. Only thing they can do is see where they are. It's a very self-centered perception of the world. From their perspective, this is the world, right? But you see this thing right here? That is the line that demonstrates the connection between what they call their world and the rest of us. Because what has happened is that Europeans have jumped out from where they are. They did that when they were here. This is how this mysterious leap from feudalism to capitalism happened that cannot be explained otherwise. And the Marxists refer to it as the primitive accumulation of capital. They didn't need any kind of explanation when they talked about the development from primitive communism to slavery to feudalism to capitalism to communism. But to get from here to here, they had to come up with the concept of the primitive accumulation of capitalism to show the development of capitalism itself, which is the time when white folks start doing good. Okay? So, here you have where the little mark is there, where Europe and Europeans are. And then they leave there and they attack the rest of the world. That's the larger thing up there. And that line represents a sort of funneling channel for all the resources that's in the rest of the world coming down into this place now where the asterisk is, into the white world, into the imperialist world, into the capitalist world.
Yes.
You with me on that? And what Marx is defining is what happens after it gets here.
Well,
everything I just told you about primitive communism, slavery, feudalism, capitalism, and communism, etc., is an explanation of what happens after all the stolen wealth and resources gets there, especially from feudalism on down. You with me? You sure?
Yeah.
Okay, what has happened? I'm going to give you this and get out of your way. Communism, by the way, is that time. They have no examples in European history of what they now call communism, what they now call communism. And communism is that time because of this progressive development of capitalism. Things just keep getting better and better. Of course, what has happened is for this thing here to start getting better and better, it was necessary with genocide, slavery,
yes,
terror, the worst kind of thing that you can imagine to happen to the rest of us.
Yes.
And so they're identifying this is progress in human society. Do you understand? This is Haiti, right? This is Africa, right? This is South America. This is even in this is what they call America now, the killing of the Indians. This is the attack on China. This is the attack on Vietnam that brought all the resources to white people and white and to Europe, right here. This is what created all the wealth and the what they call the progress in human society. You with me on that? This is what created the Industrial Revolution. This is what created computers and all the other stuff they got. They're draining it from here. They had to murder, mayhem, enslave, terrorize people right here. When I put it here, but all of it is not from long distance. Some of it is right here in the backyard, in the same territory. You understand? But what I'm explaining is that you have an economic process. You don't have two systems here. You've got one system here. It's one system that where this requires on this connection in order to keep itself fat, and then it also keeps us poor and starving in the rest of it. But the Marxists who love to talk about dialectics and the interconnectedness of the whole thing can't see the interconnectedness. They're self-centered. The only thing they can see is themselves. Right there.
That's right.
And like everybody, every civilization that's ever existed on the earth has defined the rest of the world as revolving around it. And this is what the Marxists have done. And so they blinded themselves, even when they talk about dialectic and historical materialism. That's why even Marxists who talk to us about dialectics, right? Talk to us about dialectics. They always make the point that the primary factor for social development, for development of any kind of thing, is the internal contradiction.
Yep.
They say internal contradiction. And Mao, who took up the line, more or less, talks about how, you don't know what the hell I'm talking about, do you, internal contradiction? I'm going to tell you what I'm talking about. They say that, Mao said, that the internal contradiction is the basis of change and development, while the external contradiction are the conditions for the change. And so they use as an example, Mao does, a rock and an egg. So take an egg and heat it, right? And you will get a chick from it, which is evidence that the internal contradiction is primary, he says. Then he says, but take a rock and heat it, and the only thing you'll get is a cold rock, right? But that doesn't a hot rock, but that doesn't explain anything either. Because if you get the same egg and freeze it, you just got a cold egg, don't you? In fact, the heat, the external, or the conditions were essential as the internal thing, wasn't it? Because if you just have a cold egg and you freeze a rock, you got a cold rock. And so you needed both things. You needed both the internal contradiction and you needed the conditions, the external conditions to make it happen. But this emphasis on the internal contradiction is a way of ignoring the fact that everything that happened inside Europe and for white people came as a consequence of what they were taking from other places. All right. Can you work with that? That's profoundly necessary. And that's where Penny comes in when she begins to talk to us now about the crisis. Yes, Carmen. It is. It's a really important ideological issue, theoretical issue. Because as we talk about dialectics and dialectic and historical materialism, we won't talk about it this much. But when we talk about, we say that that things change as a consequence of the contradictions that's inside the thing itself. The positives and negatives, you know, like in everything, and the basis of change and transformation in a thing or in a process, you know, has to do with the struggle between the opposites here. And the resolution, more or less, of struggle between opposites is what gives rise to development, not just in human society, but in nature as well. And Mao is correct when he talked about you can't get a chick from hitting a rock, but you can get it from hitting an egg. But because the internal contradictions are what's necessary for the development of an egg, right? The internal contradiction of a rock will not allow for you to get a chicken from it, right? But the conditions, but the problem is that they liquidate the significance of the condition and somehow makes it secondary. Because if you take the egg, the same egg that we're talking about, if the conditions for the internal contradictions to work itself are not there, you know, like I said, freeze the egg and see if you get a damn chick. Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, and so the internal contradictions and the external, and the internal conditions and the external, and the external conditions are both necessary to get the product that you want. But the European and other Marxists who follow European Marxists cannot see that. And so every time that's why they can't see, they talk about primitive communism. They can just throw it in there like it's nothing. They can liquidate the whole African and European, the African and rest of the non-white world. Here you got a Marxist from Vietnam, from China, from Cuba, offering you the same explanation about some primitive primitive accumulation of capital, giving rise to capital. What is primitive accumulation of capital? It is slavery. It is the theft of the Indians and the resources, genocide that's been committed against them. It's the attack on China, Asia, etc. This is the thing they made a footnote in the history of white people. So when they talk about the development of human society, they're not talking about the development of human society, they're talking about the development of white society. Yeah. And even when they talk about, sometimes they refer to the uncivilized peoples and the rest of us, as though we're not even entities. Not only are we not the basis or the conditions for the change, we're not even interested. We're not even worth considering in that way. I ain't one requirements as societies, as groups of people, etc. And as the world grows, then you can get a better understanding of things, and then hopefully you will leap from that. And we know we saw some Marxists come up with some pretty good observations about things like Lenin and, you know, who called himself, and Mao. Mao made incredible contributions to the struggle. He had to break a lot of the Marxist, you know, rules in order to get there, but he did. So, was that enough in terms of that? Okay. Anything else before Penny's going to take over? Yes, Carmen.
So, the primitive accumulation is not just something that happened 400 years ago, but it's an ongoing.
Well, first of all, they call it primitive accumulation. I ain't no damn primitive accumulation. That's what they call it. And what they did was enter into a relationship that they liquidate. When they talk about primitive accumulation, they liquidate the reality that this is an ongoing relationship. This is something that didn't go away. They put armies there, they put colonial powers to make sure that these resources, this relationship, and it's still there today. That's what NATO is. That's what the United Nations is, that's what IMF, all these other forces and military powers of neocolonialism is, to make sure they maintain this relationship that they call primitive accumulation. And I call it stealing every damn thing we got and then keeping us in this situation, right? Yes, my preacher.
Kumari, that's why I believe that African people and Africa, we represent the basis and the conditions of building social and economic progress.
Of course we don't. Of course we do. Okay, he's making sense. Of course we do. Because like from the Marxist perspective, it is the developmental capitalism, perfection of the process of producing what's necessary for human life, that sort of makes exploitation and things like that superfluous and non-necessary. It leads to revolutionary transformation, and now because the ability to produce what everybody needs is perfected at such a high level, everybody can have what they want, and now you have not primitive communism, but the real McCoy. Now that white people have been into this thing, right, as a consequence of this development, you have real communism, right? So that's what they say. And they say, you can see it coming, just like in the Bible. You know, I was saying that this ain't Genesis when they say there will be wars and rumors of wars and fathers will fight against sons and sons against fathers and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know that's the end of time that's coming. Is that Genesis that says that?
Revelation.
Revelations. All right, y'all teach me something. That's the era of what they call it now. Hosea?
Armageddon.
Armageddon, right? That's what you hear preachers more and more talking about every day. You turn on the television, you see preachers come out, I'm gonna get in this place. I say, you damn right. Yeah, you're right. So they say that you can see the crisis and et cetera, and they attribute the crisis to the emergence of socialism, or communism. And that's when there is no exploitation, everybody have, you know, that has what's necessary to exist. And then there's a stage between the arrival of communism, capitalism, and the arrival of communism, the overthrow of capital, and then they call that socialism. And socialism, according to them, is that place where the workers have come to power, and the existing state now is the armed working class. That is the state. Okay? Y'all with me? So what we are saying is this, that finally we see, because they call that the historical basis for the rise of socialism. And I'm saying that the historical basis for the rise of socialism has not existed up to now. That there was no, the historical basis for the rise of socialism did not exist when Lenin seized power. The historical basis for the rise of socialism did not exist when Mao seized power in China. The historical basis did not rise for the existence of socialism. The political conditions developed that allowed socialists to take power. And that's an entirely different thing. The historical basis for the rise of socialism did not exist in Russia or China. But the political conditions existed for socialists to seize power. And that's entirely different. You with me? That's why you ain't got no socialism in either place now. Huh? Yeah. Yes, my friend.
I understand what you're saying about political conditions being in place for them to take power.
Yeah.
But can you explain what the historical basis is, or can you define more?
I was just talking about the historical basis in terms of the perfection of capitalism itself, the growth of capitalism and the resolution of the contradictions of the material basis, the disappearance of the material basis for the existence of capitalism, etc. But I'm going to move from that, and because the point I want to make is this, that for the first time in human history, we're at a place for the historical basis for the advent of socialism. And what is that? We've already said that capitalism rests upon a pedestal of the slavery of African people and others around the world. The crisis that we see happening in the world today is as a consequence of oppressed peoples around the world taking back those resources that capitalism needs for its very existence. And increasingly what is clear is that the last battle of imperialism is going to be fought in Africa. Everybody has an Africa plan. Everybody's zeroing in on Africa to resolve the crisis of imperialism for the oil, for the bauxite, for the coltan, for all the stuff that's there that they need. Even battles among themselves centered in Africa. And so we say the historical basis for the advent of socialism is upon us today. Because masses of oppressed peoples around the world, especially since the Second Imperialist War, have been moving more and more to take back our resources. That's the origin of the crisis of imperialism. All right, can we work with that? Yeah. We'll talk more about it, Satish. I've seen that expression before.
Nigeria, giving crackers all the oil in our area. When you look at all the poverty in Africa, it's cause the scavengers eating the flesh, bleeding her to death. Now she trapped in a Shell gas station. They take vacations with our petrol. We living in the ghetto. They tell you not to get yours, just be satisfied to sell dope. I mean Kabila, the so-called president of Congo. Uncle Tom's like him is why we all poor. He letting thieves touch our motherland's contours. We deal with them like the white folks he follows. We getting robbed for more than a paycheck. If we was free, we wouldn't even have to pay rent. Be patient, how can I sit back and let my Africans die?
Think about it for a second, I'll get back at ya. Our motherland's in disaster. Our rubber gold and our oil's in the hands of them bastards. They still want us hauling masks up. And if the niggas act up, calling forces for the backup. Our natural resources jacked up. I mean they're deep in the pockets of a white man. Right there. Now put them up, Uncle Sam, come and fight them. Coming to the land should've been a cracker's nightmare. But you're coming with your government and gunmen. All our resources turn into your funds and Africans can't get none. 36 in a day, rude boy, bring them big guns. Cause Africans gon' rise. No apologies in the end, comrades, let's ride.
She belongs to you. Why are all Africans so poor? You can't blame it on the youth. You see, the vampire, he never tells the truth. Africa is for all Africans. She belongs to you.
But I'm afraid cause I'm a soldier, they can't take my freedom. Cause I never was free, but I hate being trapped behind them motherfucking gates. The police wanna fuck my plans off. In the future, man, it's gonna be a standoff. Hands off or I'ma shoot you, cause I'm a revolutionary to the fullest. Ready to fill a cemetery full of police that's full of bullets. We got to fight this war up in the ghetto, man, they tryna kill us. Only the realest black gorillas gonna be standing when the dust settles. The government is petrified of us black fellas. They try to keep us trapped behind that heavy metal. When they parole us, they control us, cause they hold us in the palm of their hands, squeezing, trying to crush us. I'm strong, motherfuckers. How long is my brothers gonna continue to suffer? They got a plan to put a man in a pen for life. I ain't playing by their rules, motherfucker. Them three strikes, you got to choose. What side of the fence you gon' stand? Either you gon' die with the old world or live in the new world that's coming in. And the new world is gonna be ruled by the family. Righteous black gorillas gonna complete the revolution of the 60s. Are you with me? For the year 2000, I'ma provide my people with food, clothing, and housing. BGF, Crips, Bloods, 415. We got to come together and get organized with each other. Surround me with your manpower, cause I was chosen for this hour. Talking about
Uhuru, Sasa, music, Mdugu, Ula, Wey, Ubey, Nguru, Wey. Uhuru, Sasa, music, Mdugu, Ula, Wey, Ubey, Nguru, Wey.
These old motherfuckers done sold us out for riches. Doing the revolution of the city. Half of them niggas turned snitches. Ain't no goddamn excuse for them losing their soul. They rather let them pecker woods have control over the whole ghetto population. Cowards live on their knees, giving Uncle Sam oral compilation. Motherfucking Uncle Tom nigga rose. Ain't got no goddamn self-respect. They sold it all to the redneck that put them on the payroll. Have you ever seen a black popo acting like he don't know he's on the wrong side? Switch hitter, never had no black pride. All them niggas should have died at birth. If they mama wasn't worth the pain and make it worse, they gon' be the first stupid motherfuckers to get sent to the front line. As America burst in flames, it's revolution time, nigga. How you figure you gon' live when it's over? Rather we win or rather we lose. I told you who's a threat, cause the color of your skin. And no matter how white you try to act, you can never give it back. You can never change the fact that these crackers really wanna kill us all. And your silly ass is helping to fill us into these small ass jail cells they've been building. Population control wanna stop the black male from producing more children. White man system be setting traps. It's time to resist them. Everybody get those straps. BGF, Crips, Bloods, 415. We got to come together and get organized with each other. Surround me with your manpower. I was chosen for this album. Talking about
Uhuru, Sasa, Wey, Uzi, Mdugu, Ula, Wey, Ubey, Nguru, Wey. Uhuru, Sasa, Wey, Uzi, Mdugu, Ula, Wey, Ubey, Nguru, Wey.
Hardcore revolutionary guerrilla war. Fair, don't get us to the promised land, and I'm gonna take you there. Cause I'm a guy to weigh on the front line with a reversible clip in my AK. At the same time, we gon' make the government pay for their war crimes. All they getting beginning to mind. The black man ain't free. Nah, we been in this country for over 400 years. Y'all, them honkies don't want me to tell the truth about the situation. Concern the liberation, if we want it, it's gonna take a confrontation in these days of revelation. I've been losing my religion in the middle of all the confusion. I decided to dedicate my life to the struggle like Huey Newton. I know that revolution is the only solution. Shooting is what it sounds like when a black gorilla cry. In this guerrilla warfare, some of us got to die. This is the second resurrection of the struggle. It's about to be a rumble in the jungle. They wanna lock me down, but they rather have me dead instead. Cause as long as I'm alive, the revolution's gonna be led in the right direction. I know the reason why the black section of every city is called a ghetto, where every ghetto dweller gotta deal with police aggression. Ain't you tired of oppression, black genocidal deception? BGF, Crips, Bloods, 415. We got to come together and get organized with each other. Surround me with your manpower, cause I was chosen for this hour. Talking about
Uhuru, Sasa, Wey, Uzi, Nguru, Ula, Wey, Ubey, Nguru, Wey. Uhuru, Sasa, Wey, Uzi, Nguru, Ula, Wey, Ubey, Nguru, Wey. Uhuru, Sasa, Wey, Uzi, Nguru, Ula, Wey, Ubey, Nguru, Wey. Uhuru, Sasa, Wey, Uzi, Nguru, Ula, Wey, Ubey, Nguru, Wey.
It's the general of who, and assalamu alaikum to the degree of the creator's master plan. Answer on Muhammad, so called the mother who I killed. Answer on Muhammad, so called Tracy. Answer on Muhammad, so called Scariac. Answer on Muhammad, so called Father Mo. Give it up to the Master J. This is the new millennium, baby. The age of Aquarius. You dead?
African People's Socialist Party Chairman Omali Yeshitela's new book, One Africa, One Nation, is available now. In this historic collection, the chairman and representatives of the emerging African Socialist International explain why Africa and all its resources must be liberated and in the hands of African workers and peasants in Africa and everywhere. The chairman's new book, One Africa, One Nation, documents the process of building the African Socialist International, which is rapidly growing in countries throughout Africa and in the U.S., the Caribbean, and elsewhere around the world. For pictures of the chairman's recent book signing tour, and to order your copy of One Africa, One Nation, go to burningspearuhuru.com. That's www.burningspearuhuru.com. Uhuru, and welcome back to Africa Live on uhururadio.com. I'm your host, Nibinga Zimbabwe, and we've been playing up to now part of the political education classes that happened on October 1st through 4th in Huntsville, Alabama, following the IMPEDUM convention, the convention of the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement. This was a party-sponsored school, and we've been playing a study session on political economy. And what we've played so far has been a piece led by Chairman Amalia Shetela. What we're going to go into now is a part of that study that was led by Comrade Penny Hess, who is the chairwoman of the African People Solidarity Committee. So this is that presentation here.
Uhuru. I just want to express my unity with the chairman's presentation that he just gave, and that was an excellent overview for this presentation. And, you know, I wanted to start out by saying that, as most people know, the African People Solidarity Committee is... does to the white workers, it doesn't take into account that all the resources from Africa and from around the world have been stolen just to make the products, to be able to have the white working class and the white population that exists. And so therefore, the existence of the African People Solidarity Committee has a theoretical basis, because white people sit on the pedestal of the oppression of African people, and the destruction of imperialism means African people are bringing down the pedestal. So therefore, the only way that white people can participate in the revolutionary process is under the leadership of African people and other people to make up the pedestal. And I think that is really important. And because APFC is under the leadership of the party, and because of this, we have understood that one of our key responsibilities is in going back into the white community to, I guess you could say, reverse this flow, to bring the resources out and turn them back over to the African Revolution. So part of what APSC has always done, or what it has been about, has been, you know, building institutions, resources that win resources, that gain resources, under the leadership of the party and turn it over. Like Uhuru Foods is one of the institutions. APSC plays a role in the Uhuru furniture stores and these other kinds of things. So this being the fact, it's always, earlier this year, I started to see articles in the newspaper, not really the newspaper, on the internet, about this impending crisis of United States imperialism, of U.S. economic power. And I wanted to understand it more, because APSC is involved in different institutions that raise resources. So I wanted to understand how this was going to affect what we do, and I began to study it, and I found it to be very difficult to understand. So I had to, like, really sort of, you know, give myself a course in this economic language that they were talking about, and that's some of what I want to talk about today. But the things that it became really clear to me were three things in particular. One is that the bourgeois economists have no clue about what is happening. The only way to understand it is to understand the theory that the chairman is putting out, African internationalism. This question of the theft of the resources and this pedestal that's built on the backs of African people and the peoples on the planet Earth. The other thing that became very clear, if you really study it, is that this gap between, as they say, the wealthy, the rich, and the poor is getting greater. So therefore, it means a smaller percentage of the white population is controlling more resources. Therefore, in this crisis of the U.S. economy, the world capitalist economy, the standard of living of white people on the pedestal is going to go down, and it's going to go way down, because they don't need so many white people on the pedestal anymore. And thirdly, that African people, of course around the world, but inside the United States, as always, are going to pay the price of this economic crisis. And these are the things that I wanted to talk about a little bit in this presentation. And this is actually a presentation that I gave to the African People Solidarity Committee Economic Development Commission a couple of weeks ago. So, the collapse of the parasitic capitalist economy and the rise of African national liberation. So just to say again, all the understandings in this presentation come from the theory of Chairman Omali Yeshitela, African internationalism, and the understandings of the African People's Socialist Party. These are not understandings or ideas that I can come to or anything. Actually, I can't do it well. But I wanted to also say that this has a lot of information in this presentation, and of course the chairman will intervene at any time, but I also wanted to say that if anybody has a question, go ahead and ask now. A lot of times we save it to the end, but I think it would be more helpful in this situation to go ahead and ask, or if you have a comment. And also I know that Luwazi knows quite a bit more, probably much more than I do, about the current situation economically, so
I don't.
Of course. Okay. All right, so again, we see, as the chairman talked about, we can see the crisis of imperialism politically by this war, this U.S. war in Afghanistan against the Iraqi people that it can't get out of. And, you know, all around the world, we see war and struggle and terror by U.S. imperialism. But we can also see that there is nothing today that U.S. imperialism can be optimistic about. If you really think about that. I mean, my father says when he was young, you know, capitalism was optimistic about everything. There's absolutely nothing that it is optimistic. You don't pick up a newspaper and say, you know, read an article that says in 5 years we're going to be here or we're going to be there. They can't control global warming. They can't control the U.S. soldiers coming back in body bags. They can't win the war in Iraq. They can't deal with the infrastructure that's falling down of roads and bridges, which they say 75,000 bridges are ready to collapse. They can't deal with health care. They can't deal with the uninsured. I mean, there's nothing that, you know, that imperialism.
Folks
got to
drive back.
I can try that in the paper. So one of the key things is the U.S. economic collapse that we don't hear that much about, because the ruling class, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post, in particular CNN, all these things that really cover it over, or they give you little snippets of it here and there, and they never put it all together. But we can see, I had this picture because some people compare the situation now to the Depression of 1929, and I think it's always interesting that when you see the pictures of the Depression, you see white people. You never see, of course, African people were, you know, it was always like that for that. And what happened was white people had to experience some of the conditions that Africans did for, you know, a few years. But in fact, even during the Depression, the white ruling class became richer and richer and richer, and this is happening now. But even what the situation was in 1929 was nothing like the crisis of imperialism now. It was much deeper. So we know that and what I'm going to do actually in this presentation is I'm going to sum up a little bit in the beginning what is happening. Then I want to go into the analysis of the background of the chairman's theory for how it got to be the way it is. And then I want to go back to some of the specific questions and things that are happening in the U.S. economy right now. But in March of this year, there was the collapse of what they call the subprime mortgage industry. And it brought down what they called the housing bubble. And what that was because of low interest rates by the Federal Reserve for mortgages and other kinds of loans, it encouraged a huge amount of speculation on houses and what they called flipping houses. They have whole channels on TV on just how to flip a house. And, you know, it became a place where basically regular white working people could make a lot of money. And generally speaking, when they did that, it was in the African community, and that was called gentrification. Well, a lot of the mortgages that were given, especially to the African community, were called subprime mortgages. Subprime is opposed to prime. Prime, the prime customers, which are generally white, and I'll get to this later, are people who have quote a good credit rating, and therefore, you know, they would be given the lower and fixed interest rates on a mortgage. Subprime, which was generally African, who supposedly did not have good credit ratings, although that is not true whatsoever, were given adjustable rate mortgages, which are also called ARMs, adjustable rate mortgages, that start out low, but after 2 years, they reset sometimes $1,000 to $1,500 a month higher than they were to begin with. So $2.28 trillion in adjustable rate mortgages were given in 2004, 5, and 6, and more than half of them to African people. In October 2007, right now, in fact, today, $50 billion in adjustable rate mortgages will reset at higher rates, and over $1 trillion next year in those mortgages. In 2005, 17 million households in the U.S. put half their income into housing, into rent and mortgages. And millions of people now face foreclosure, which means that the banks will own the property. So this is Ben Bernanke, who is the head of the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States. And this is Henry Paulson, who is Secretary of the Treasury. And when this happened in March with the collapse of the subprime, which means that the major mortgage lenders of the subprime mortgages went bankrupt. I think one of them was called American Home Mortgage. It went bankrupt, and therefore, you know, there were so many defaults and people who cannot pay their mortgages. But Paulson and Bernanke said, it's no problem. The subprime mortgage industry is contained. It will not infect the rest of the U.S. economy. But, in fact, that was completely false. Because in July of this year, Bear Stearns, which is the largest investment firm in Wall Street in the United States, had to bail out two of its hedge funds, supposedly worth hundreds of billions of dollars because they had bought what they call packages of bundled subprime mortgage loans, proving that the problem was not contained. And what that means is, first of all, that the housing bubble has officially burst. Mm-hmm. It's over. But secondly, what it means when the investment firms bought the mortgages is that, say you got a mortgage from Wachovia Bank. Wachovia Bank takes a whole bunch of subprime mortgages and bundles them up into a, it's called another product. And they create a whole new entity that's called something like a server vehicle or something. You know, they have words for all this. And what they say about this SVP or whatever it is a separate entity that is, quote, bankruptcy remote. Therefore, nobody takes responsibility for it. And it goes through that and bundles up these subprime mortgages to minimize the risk and sells them to the high-risk investment funds, such as hedge funds on Wall Street. It's, you know, we will talk about this more, but it's a way that, you know, it just shows it's parasitism on top of parasitism. It's like making money out of nothing. So what they do, what the hedge funds do, what a hedge fund is for millionaires to have risky investments and possibly, and usually, make a lot of money. I'll go into it more. They raid economies all over the world. They destroy the currencies of colonized countries. They, you know, it's just like playing with Wall Street, playing with the numbers, and further impoverishing people around the world while making the bankers very, very wealthy. So they said it was contained, but in August of this year, construction lost 22,000 jobs, totaling almost 100,000 lost in the past year. In July, new housing starts reached a 10-year low. People in contract to purchase previously owned homes plummeted 12.2% in July, the most ever. And more than a year's supply of houses are now in the market. And you can see all over the country, just for sale signs, 2 or 3 on every block. Home Depot stocks are way down. They don't know how they're going to make it. The U.S. auto industry is in bad shape. And in August, they said the U.S. economy lost 4,000 jobs, which they were surprised. They thought it was going to increase by 150,000 jobs, which is a bunch of bullshit, because that's just manufactured. The data to say that they lost 4,000 jobs. They lost many, many more. I mean, where are all these realtors working now? hundreds of thousands of jobs have been lost. So in August, the Federal Reserve Bank put $38 to $60 billion to bail out the bankers. They put it into Wall Street. They didn't bail out the African community who got these fraudulent loans from these swindlers, but they paid the people who made the billions of dollars on the loans, on again, exploiting African people and other people. They paid them back, basically. The U.S. government gave them the money so that they would not go bankrupt. And around the world, central banks put in over $300 billion in the stock market to stave off a crash of the stock market. Meanwhile, at the same time, oil prices are up. Now they're hovering between $81 and $83 a barrel. This is an all-time record, and we have to remember that only 5 years ago, oil was $19 a barrel. And it's going to be $100 a barrel probably by the end of this year. So, you know, this is really significant. The U.S. has never faced this before. Gold prices are also skyrocketing, and they're over $700 an ounce right now, expected to go up to $850 an ounce in the next few weeks. And the important thing about this is that it corresponds with the drop of the dollar for the first time in history. Because prior to this, when oil went up, the dollar went up. But now it's an inverse relationship. The oil is going up, the dollar is going down, down, down. And one of the reasons why is that around the world, the people are buying oil in the euro, not the dollar. So that, and this is a huge blow, because U.S. imperialism always controlled the economy of the world. So right now, the dollar is at least $1.40 to the euro, which is probably more than that today. This was written a few weeks ago. And, you know, I mean, that's like, if we had to go to the ASI meeting in London right now, it would probably be like $30 just to buy lunch or something. I mean, it's a very, very, you know, serious contradiction for imperialism. Also, a few weeks ago, people might have noticed that in England, at the Northern Rock Bank in Britain, it was hit by what they call a run on the banks, where everybody went to the bank, waited in line all day, and said, we want our money back. We don't want to be in the bank. Which a bank can't do. It can't give you all its money, because it only has 20% of what they... When you say your money's in the bank, that bank only has at least 20% of that. So they couldn't do it, and all the U.S. banks are really afraid that this is going to be happening, and it is going to happen. So at the very least, we can say that the U.S. is at the end of the supreme hegemony of U.S. imperial economic power in the world. It is challenged on every front. And this is what some economists are saying. Underneath the subprime meltdown is continuing to weaken the USA's ability to grow. The scale of the problem is frightening to them. It's looking much larger than any crisis they hit since Second World War. We are facing something even more serious than the Depression of 1929, the permanent loss of the US, of the Western world's position on top of the economic heap. And I think that's...
Where did that quote come from?
Yeah. I'm not sure. I have so many different things, but there was also an article recently in the Los Angeles Times called The End of the Empire that was dealing with some of this as well. So the U.S. is attempting to solve its economic problems by deepening the extraction of resources from Africa and other places in the world. And as we know, in Africa, more than half of the population lives on less than $2 a day, lives on, you know, nothing, basically. But inside the United States, the U.S. is also attempting to save itself on the backs of African people. Now, this is Brooklyn foreclosure pattern 2006. That's before the crisis happened. I couldn't get it for now. But the 10 areas are more than 50% African or Spanish speaking. That was 2006, all the houses in foreclosure. Now it's double or triple that. And that means all those houses are going to be owned by the bank. Yes.
Does that mean that the banks are going to, you know, banks are definitely not happy about foreclosures, are they?
No, they're not. It does create a crisis for them because they cannot get the value out of it. But it also means, I mean, of course, they're selling them. They're selling them, but it means that they're selling them at a lower price, exactly. But they don't make their money back. No, they're not happy about it at all. So every day we can read scores of articles summing up the economic crisis, but we cannot understand it without understanding African nationalism. And as the chairman tells us, the immediate imperial crises are brought about by the resistance of colonized peoples around the world against imperialism for the past 60 years. And that the genocidal wars of the U.S. that have slaughtered more than a million Iraqi people and the occupation of Afghanistan cost the U.S. so far $450 billion. An additional $200 million every single day. The oil prices are going up, and the BBC News reported that oil traders have been worried about potential supply disruptions to the oil supply, including further possible attacks by insurgents
in Nigeria's oil-rich Niger Delta, and in Mexico, where oil pipelines were hit by explosions this week, which were perpetrated by the Popular Revolutionary Army in Oaxaca. So, you know, the resistance, and people have read about men in Nigeria, the revolutionary force, or the force, the guerrilla force that is saying if Africans in Nigeria do not benefit from the oil that is now owned by Shell Oil, which takes out $300 billion a year in oil from Nigeria, that nobody was going to have, you know, if Africans didn't have it, nobody was going to have this. And we've seen a lot of kidnappings and other kinds of trouble going on there. Oh, yes, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, the question of the banks are saying, I don't know, selling stuff, because I thought I read somewhere where they were giving people mortgages because of the crisis that the banks are selling.
That's right.
So are they selling, what percentage of the houses that they're acquiring, are they selling? Is that part of the contradiction that they have all these houses that...
Yeah. That they have exact, well, it is, because see, the point is that the mortgage industry is not isolated. So when it goes bankrupt, for the bank's already sold them to the Wall Street investment firm, so it goes all the way up. But yeah, they can't sell them right now. It's very hard to do, and it's creating a crisis, not just for the banks, but even for Wall Street. And that's right, they're not giving any mortgages right now because also, so one of part of the crisis of imperialism was the struggle that just happened in Guinea-Conakry earlier this year, which cost Alcoa Aluminum $12 million in lost revenues, quote unquote, that they were stealing from Guinea-Conakry. And I think one of the significant points of that, the most significant point was the document, the platform put forward by the African Socialist International that stated the interests of African workers and peasants, which is the first time really since the 60s or 70s that such a revolutionary statement has come out. And I thought it was very interesting during the time that the strike was going on in Guinea-Conakry to look on the internet, and there were strikes going on in other countries, but they were tremendously worried about the situation in Guinea. And they sent in presidents of Liberia and all kinds of ambassadors and everything possible to get them to, you know, put down the situation. So the power of the African Socialist International is one of the things that is really, really, really significant to imperialism's ability to continue to rape Africa. Also, Venezuela is very important. I was just reading today, or the other day, in the New York Times, an article that was saying that the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, is increasingly irrelevant. Well, one of the reasons is that Venezuela led a movement to use its oil money that it has in its country to, first of all, pay back everything that it, quote, owed to the IMF and quit it. And then it created its own investment resources for countries around the world that want to use it for genuine economic development, not what the IMF does. So, but this whole article in the New York Times didn't even mention that. That's the key reason why the IMF is irrelevant. But another thing that Venezuela just did, and I think it was really brilliant, was that a couple of weeks ago, OPEC, oil-producing country, had its annual meeting, or quarterly or whatever meeting, in Vienna. And Venezuela is a member of OPEC. And Venezuela struggled that the OPEC countries would not increase their oil production. Now, the U.S. was calling for OPEC to make an increase of something like 1.3 million barrels more a year, a day, I think it is. I'm sorry, a year a day. I can't remember what it was.
A day,
to be produced. And Venezuela's like organized Algeria, Libya, Iran, and other countries to say, we don't need an increase. We don't need it to do that increase, knowing that, one, it would drive up oil prices for their people higher, and two, it would deepen the economic crisis inside the U.S. So they struggled and struggled and struggled, and I was kind of following that on the news, and every night the media would be like, we're standing out in front, we don't know what their decision is, we need them to. And finally, they made the announcement, and Saudi Arabia said, well, we feel that we have to give some increase in production because we want to avert a world economic crisis. So of course, they had to make a compromise. They didn't win the struggle, but they only agreed to produce only 500,000 barrels a day, as opposed to, so it's less than half of what the U.S. wants. So then the U.S. announced that in fact it has a tremendous shortage. It has more of a shortage than they thought. So this winter, if the U.S. has a hard winter, or if there's any kind of disruption, as they say, in Nigeria, in Mexico, if there's a hurricane, the U.S. has 19 days supplies, days of oil in reserve right now only, right? 19 days at any given time. So if there's anything that happens, and it doesn't have to lose a lot of oil. If it loses 2% of what it needs, it will go into a huge crisis. So this is also going to drive up the cost of everything we eat. All our food is going up 30, 40, 50%, you know, this winter, and this is part of the crisis. But I think that it's really interesting and important that Venezuela, you know, led that struggle economically. They couldn't fight the U.S. militarily, but they could do that, and that was powerful. So we have to understand what the chairman was talking about earlier, that in the 19th century, as the chairman showed us, Karl Marx began to question how capitalism was born. And it was an important inquiry, considering that pre-capitalist Europe was impoverished, oppressed, and backwards. And Marx wrote, "The discovery of gold and silver in America, the extirpation, enslavement, and entombment in mines of the aboriginal population, the beginning of the conquest and looting of the East Indies, the turning of Africa into a warren for the commercial hunting of black skins, signaled the rosy dawn of the era of capitalist production." Marx says, "These idyllic proceedings are the chief momentum of primitive accumulation. On their heels treads the commercial war of the European nations with the globe for a theater. It begins with the revolt of the Netherlands from Spain, assumes giant dimensions in England's anti-Jacobin war, and is still going on in the opium wars against China." And I think that it's really important to notice that the chairman is the one that brought out the significance of this quote, which is way back, like on page 800 of something, of Marx's book, Das Kapital. I mean, it's not even central to his understanding, it's just a footnote, but the chairman gave it its significance as what created capitalism. And I would just like to say, when Marx talks about the revolt of the Netherlands from Spain, what he's talking about is that at that time, Spain controlled the world trade in African people. He's talking about that was like in the 1500s. Spain controlled it. And they also occupied Holland, which is Netherlands. They occupied parts of it. And so what the Dutch were fighting for was not only Spain out of their country, but the right also to participate in the trade in African people. That's what that war was called, the 30 Years' War. That's what it was about. And, you know, it's like it all has to do with this. So the chairman also compares the writings of the Russian revolutionary V.I. Lenin, who wrote in the early 20th century that imperialism had become parasitic and had gotten rotten right in the 19th century. So what I think is really interesting, because Lenin says that this is his definition of imperialism. This is not a definition, it is a description. The chairman gave a definition to imperialism. But what Lenin said, and this is interesting, because he was writing in, like in the, maybe the 19-teens or the early 20s, but it is really what's happening now is exactly what he was talking about, only it has come more, you know, developed. He's saying the concentration of capital, monopolies play a decisive role in economic life. Well, okay, so we know that. Finance capital oligarchy, merging of bank capital with industrial capital. What he's talking about is exactly what's in the United States. There is no mode of production. There's Wall Street. Wall Street is bankers playing money around. It has nothing to do, when they talk about the economy of the U.S., it has nothing to do with production in the U.S. It has to do with playing with money by the ruling class. The export of capital as distinguished from export of commodities. Isn't that called outsourcing today? Where they take everything out and they put it down in colonized countries so that the labor can be cheaper. International monopolist capitalist combines which share the world among themselves. That would be multinational corporations. They have no loyalty to any boundaries or to the U.S. or anything else anymore. Territorial division of the whole world among the biggest capitalist powers. So what we're seeing today is exactly that. It's the same condition that Lenin described. But it took Chairman O'Malley to tell us 100 years later, 70 years later, to give it the understanding. And the chairman said, I pose to you that capitalism was born parasitic. There was never a time that capitalism was not parasitic. It was born off the slave trade. Marx referred to the primitive accumulation of capital, the accumulation that didn't come as a consequence of capitalist production, but it was its starting point. Capitalism was born from the slave trade, unquote. So one of the chairman's most important points in understanding the U.S. economy and the world capitalist economy is that all classes of white people sit on the pedestal of African and colonized people. The chairman said there is an objective relationship between world slavery and U.S. affluence, and up until now, the North American population opportunistically and demagogically, led by their stomachs, pocketbooks, and corrupt leadership, have chosen the continued enslavement of the world. So, the point is that under feudalism that the chairman talked about in Europe, peasants had no rights and no money. Europeans became workers, became the working class, on the pedestal of African enslavement. So that even a white worker has an interest in maintaining his situation on the pedestal. And that's the difference between the chairman, the white left, or anybody else is analyzing the U.S. economy. So just as much as the bourgeoisie and middle class got their place in Europe and America based on the oppression of African people and peoples around the world, African white workers have their place on the pedestal based on the oppression of African people. So the entire U.S. economy, North and South, was built on the enslavement of African people. And the more we study this, the more that's really clear. The least important sector of the U.S. economy in terms of the trade in African people were the plantation owners of the South.
Yeah.
Capitalism in the U.S. was built, the North, New York, the cotton industry, the garment industry of New York, the rum and every possible thing was built based on this. This is Chaco Bottom area of Richmond, Virginia, where 350,000 Africans were auctioned over a period of only like 100 years or 80 years or something like that. But to think of the economy that it built was railroads, taverns, banks, hotels, universities, all of the Harvard, Brown University, all endowed by the slave ship owners, law firms, insurance companies, brokerage houses, all of that sprang out of the trade in African people. So when white workers came to America, South Africa, Australia, or any place else, they recognized that it was a ticket to more power and resources on the pedestal of the oppression of African people. So that's why white workers, there wasn't a memo sent out by the US government calling on white working people to lynch Africans. That was voluntary. That was something white people did. And if it wasn't, you know, it wasn't mandatory that white people picked up a gun against the indigenous people. That was a volunteer cavalry. But white people joined it. They didn't get paid for that. They did it on purpose because they understood that their interests were at the expense of African people, their most, you know, vulgar, their basest interests for money and power were at the expense of African people. And recently, Nzinga's been playing some on Uhuru Radio quotes from Marcus Garvey. People have probably heard it from some of his speeches. And there's one place where Marcus Garvey is saying to the audience of African people, you don't have anything in common with white workers, as the Communist Party will tell you. I'm paraphrasing, but you know, he's saying that because the Communist Party says that the slogan should be black and white, unite and fight. And Garvey said, you don't have anything in common. White working people are the ones that are lynching you. So today we have white workers, Abu Ghraib, Virginia, just recently West Virginia, where they tortured an African woman for a week. I think this is Gina, Louisiana. And there's always this line that white workers are duped. Nobody else in the world gets to be duped. Everybody else has to take responsibility for their actions. White people even made, you know, the Germans have to take responsibility for what they did to the Jews. But white people don't have to take responsibility. And it's the same line, because they always say there's whole books out by the Communist Party called The Tragedy of Lynching. They're not talking about the tragedy against African people, they're saying the tragedy that white people didn't understand what they were doing. And it's the same line that you hear that, you know, white people were duped by Bush's lies, the weapons of mass destruction. When a 10-year-old in Kenya can tell you that, you know, but a Harvard graduate in the United States, you know, or a high school graduate couldn't tell you something about that. That's the responsibility that white society is built on, the oppression of African people inside this country and around the world. And I think that one of, you know, the best metaphors is that an African cemetery, usually when it's African or indigenous, white people call it a burial ground. And for white people, it's a cemetery. A cemetery was found under Wall Street of African people who lived in the tip of Wall Street, in tip of Manhattan in the 18th century, enslaved at times, won their freedom. They had fierce resistance. The whole history that we could go into, but the history of enslaved Africans in New York was powerful. But I think that that is a perfect analogy, a perfect metaphor for the United States, that the wealth of U.S. imperialism rests literally on the bodies of African people. Every time after the enslavement of African people, and even during, that African people gained wealth, and many, many places, this is so covered, you know, wiped out of the history books, but it happened everywhere, not just Rosewood, not just Tulsa. In every state, there were whole communities of African people. I know I grew up around Louisville. There was Berry Town. There was even a section of town called Little Africa that had a thriving economy. But every time they were attacked by white people and the economies were destroyed. And it's always really important to bring out Tulsa, Oklahoma, because you hear about that, but you have to really think about, I mean, this wasn't like little storefronts. They had high high-rise buildings. I mean, the so-called incident of a white person that happened, where they said an African man did something, you know, like spoke to a white woman, was in an elevator in one of these buildings. It was the Wall Street. It was a powerful, I'd like to find out more about it. I'm sure it had even international implications to the economy that was built there. And it was aerial bombed by the United States with bombs, and it was completely burnt down by white mobs, and the community was destroyed and driven out.
Finn, just a moment, you know, I really think it's important to understand this era, because we get talked about the inability of African people to do things like economically, and how we have to be dependent on white folks, are the only ones, but that was less than 60 years after the end of the slavery.
Right.
So after less than 60 years after the end of slavery, you see the incredible kind of economic life that African people have developed, which, you know, just goes to show that if we get white power out of the way, you understand, you know,
yeah.
And this is even though we were in a hostile colonial territory, with less than 60 years, we had developed these economic fronts. And then, of course, Garvey developed steamship lines, even where most of Africa was still under colonial slavery. So it's just a statement. All this stuff about what Africa and African people cannot do, the issue is not that. It's white power on top of our backs. Yeah,
and, you know, in Tulsa, I mean, people lived in huge houses.
Yeah.
But it was also, from everything I've read about it, that they allowed, I think the community was called Greenwood, they allowed no family to be impoverished. Every family was brought into the economy. It was very collective, and there was a powerful thing that much more should need to be brought out about. But also, as the chairman was saying, Marcus Garvey, which had, as he said, the steamship line, he had laundries and dry cleaners and record companies and all different kinds of things, a huge economy, and that was what was attacked by imperialism. We also have to really understand that after the end of enslavement, there was the system called convict leasing. That was the re-enslavement of Africans. That there were millions of Africans caught up by Jim Crow laws, and everything Africans did was illegal. Any business that they started they made a law against it.
Yeah.
And then arrested them,
yeah.
and put them in the concentration camp called convict leasing. Then leased Africans out to the former plantation owners to rebuild the southern economy after the Civil War.
Yeah.
So that Alabama, the state, 73% of its total revenue in 1898 came from this concentration camp labor of African people. And that went on until the late 1920s, or maybe even early 1930s.
Yeah.
So 1913.
Hold it. I just want to say that convict leasing may have lasted until the 1930s, but not the exploitation of African prison labor. It just changed. Parchment and prisons, you know, even the state of Alabama, where they turned huge farms and stuff like that. So as convict leasing, the only difference was that with convict leasing, we were not owned by individual white people, and we became possession of the state. And then they would lease us out to white people who didn't even have to give us shelter. In many instances, didn't give Africans shelter. Literally, Africans slept outside and just worked for white people. It didn't matter if we died. They had a saying, if one dies, get another. And then out of this developed, you know, like prisons, like Parchman, Angola, and other, and here in the state of Alabama, I can't remember some of the names from the notorious prison, Rayford, Florida. And then they were huge plantations. The prisons themselves were like plantations where agricultural products, essentially, and other kinds of products were developed. The prison system in this country is now has this immediate basis off of the enslavement of the African experience following the convict leasing and et cetera. I just think it's really important to understand that we talked about what the convict leasing did in terms of contribution to the economy of the South, but also even after convict leasing, the plantations that we were on that they were now calling prisons, you know, were vicious, and it gave us even a more isolation. The murders and things that happened in these prisons here, Arkansas and what have you, were literally Africans were buried, killed and buried on the prison grounds that people never heard of them, you know, like anymore. And that's all over the southern part of the United States.
Mm-hmm. And that, this stuff has to be really studied because they talk about Holocaust. I mean, nobody talks about convict leasing when the motto was, like the chairman said, one dies, get another.
Yeah.
You know, just work people to death.
And it was worse than slavery,
yeah.
Literally, and what they call slavery. I don't even like the concept of slavery. I call it colonial slavery, you know, but because, you know, people talk about, well, there was slavery in Africa, there was slavery. It's nonsense. Nothing on earth has ever happened to, like, what happened to African people on the entire continent was taken and drained and then held in captivity, and our people dispersed around the world, and the kinds of things that happened to us. But it was worse than the Uhuru.
This concludes what we'll be playing today of this study. But we'll continue it again on next week, the study on political economy. So stay tuned for more great programming here on UhuruRadio.com. Up next, you have Uhuru on the Move.
Children of the Master Man, we are the children of the Higher Man. Africa, unite, 'cause the children wanna come home, yeah, yeah. Africa, unite, 'cause we're moving right out of Babylon, and we're grooving.
Things that's held us down, but now it looks like things are finally coming around. I know we've got a long, long way to go, and where we'll end up, I don't know. But we won't let nothing hold us back. We're putting our show together, we're polishing up our act. And if you've ever been held down before, I know you refuse to be held down anymore.
Don't you let nothing, nothing
stand in your way.
I want y'all to listen, listen
to every word I say, every word I say. Trying to make it, they only push you aside. They really don't have nowhere to go. Ask them where they're.
they're going, they don't know. But we won't let nothing hold us back. We're gonna put our show together, gonna polish up our act now. And if you've ever been held down before, I know you refuse to be held down anymore. Well,
don't you let
tuned into Uhuru on the Move. This is the radio show of the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement. We're here today with our new host, myself, Ivory Muhammad. I'm the president-elect of the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement. And we're also here with our co-host, Kobina Bantu-Shango. Uhuru, Kobina.
Uhuru. Uhuru, Comrade President Ivory.
Our former host and former president of Impedum, Chimurenga Waller, has passed the torch of Uhuru on the Move to me, and I look forward to a great future of shows that, with our dedicated listeners, that will bring the voice of the African community online from the perspective of the African working class, whose objective is self-determination. Today on our show, we have two segments. On the for the first half of our show until 1:30, we'll have Ajimu Bendele, who is the York, Pennsylvania president of Impedum. And on the second half of our show, we'll be speaking with the African Internationalist Student Organizing Committee. Right now we do have the president of York, Pennsylvania branch of Impedum on the line, Ajimu Bendele. Uhuru, Ajimu.
Uhuru, Conrad.
Uhuru. So, Ajumu, I understand that there's an initiative, anti-gang initiative, 222 gang initiative, that the federal government has implemented that's given $1 billion to different areas to promote anti-gang activity in our communities. I understand this poses a threat to the African community of Pennsylvania as well as other areas, and I want to see if